Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Matthew Johnson, and I'm here today with Devin Fergus, Arvar E. Strickland Distinguished Professor of History, Black Studies, and Public Affairs at the University of Missouri, about his new book, Land of the Fee, The Hidden Costs, and the Decline of the American Middle Class. Devin, welcome to the program.
Matt, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
So your first book, Liberalism, Black Power, and the Making of American Politics, gave us this really innovative look at Black Power's impact on politics from the mid-1960s to 1980 or so. And what brought you from Black Power to this book about fees?
Great question. It's really about sort of following the money. So the first book, which, as you said, it looks at the interplay between liberalism and Black Power, follows the money, the ways in which liberalism and liberal organizations and projects underwrote the rise of Black institutional power, Black power institutional rise. And so the next project, Land of the Fee, sort of continues that sort of theme of following the money. And here the money is the rise of fees and for conveyances of mobility in American life, housing, education, employment, and what kicks us from home to school and work, transportation. We see a rise of fees in those four spheres that really erect barriers of mobility for the average American. So in the first project stops in 1980, and the second project sort of picks up at that sort of juncture since 1980 to see what happens during the denouement of liberalism and the rise of conservatism and the rise of deregulation.
And when you titled this book Land of the Fee, so when you're talking about fees, what sort of stuff were you actually talking about?
Absolutely. So I'm talking about concrete fees, let's say, for instance, in housing, prepayment penalty fees, balloon payment fees and things like that. But I'm also talking in a broader sense, not simply fees, but any kind of extra additional charge beyond the principal. And so for instance, when I talk about my sphere on employment, which looks at the rise of payday lending, which is really the free market sort of most ubiquitous response to the crisis, generational crisis of wage stagnation, there you see a rise of fees in a form of interest rates. Or as lenders often say, well, these aren't interest rates, these are actual fees. And so fees can take the form of actual fees or take the form of interest rates. Or we see fees in terms of any kind of padded costs, let's say, for the rise of student loans, anything beyond the actual principal. And so, I mean, anything beyond the sort of the actual principal of a cost. That's basically what I mean by fee in this sense.
And you know, you really point to the 1970s and especially the early 1980s as this major kind of turning point where these fees really start to kind of to arise. And so what happens in this moment, 1970s, early 1980s, that allows all of these things to really be imposed on Americans?
Great question. Really what happens in a broader sense is we see in a rise of financial deregulation and this financial deregulation sort of creates the space for the private sector, for consumer financial in consumer financial industry to increase the cost and expenses. And so, for instance, there was a major court case in the mid-1970s, which enables banks specifically to charge higher fees and higher rates than they did before. And so we see the rise of financial deregulation, which occurs and it begins in the 1970s and 1980s. And that would be sort of, we create the space for the rise of these fees and costs.
And so you start the book talking about, you know, subprime mortgages, which, you know, Americans now kind of understand what those things are. But you point to this law that's passed in 1980 that most Americans have probably never heard of, that seemed to just change everything. And so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about this really kind of boring sounding name that's just so important, which is the Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980.
Thanks, Matt. I'm glad you actually said the actual piece of legislation because it's a real tongue twister. So, no, you're absolutely right. So, in 1980, Congress passes a law called, and it's pronounced sort of DIDMA. That's the shorthand for it. As you mentioned before, Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, and basically DIDMA is designed to allow for lenders, mortgage lenders specifically, to increase the interest rates that they're charging customers and consumers. And the belief is that this passage of DIDMA in 1980 because it has to do with depository institutions, would actually put more money into the pockets of average account holders. So yes, you might be charged more for a mortgage loan in terms of interest rate, but this money is going to trickle down to the consumer. And so the way in which it was explained to the consumer was that this is going to actually put more money into the savings accounts of the average account holder. This is why, for instance, the Grey Panthers, one of the more progressive / radical groups of the 1970s, actually supported this financial deregulation. Because the fundamental belief is that it's going to increase the savings for the average American. And what we see actually is that not simply has financial deregulation not increased the savings for the average American, but in reality, actually financial deregulation has actually driven more Americans deeper and deeper into debt. And so, again, the original intent of financial deregulation was to help average Americans sort of save more. We can look at this law and say, and question, again, the original purpose, original intent of financial deregulation in and of itself. And say, has it lived up to its original purpose, original intent?
Yeah, what's maybe, you know, why so many Americans don't know about this act is because, you know, some of the provisions really weren't taken advantage of until later on. And so I was wondering, you know, why don't these subprime mortgages, you know, become really popular until later on, like, you know, really 1990s, I think that you point to in this book.
Sure. It's a great question. I'm going to sort of say why many Americans don't know about it is in part because, as you sort of hinted at, the law is, it seems complicated, it seems bland. And even though the Carter administration said that this is going to create a new financial world, Americans in 1980 cared little about this revolutionary law. It was revolutionary. And in fact, as I sort of talk about in my text, news reports buried it in the back segments. They were more interested in the retirement of Roger Staubach, the star quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, than a revolutionary law which is going to fundamentally change how people sort of spend their money, how people sort of save. And so even from the beginning, there was a lack of interest and concern of the consumer with this complicated law. So what happens in the 1980s, there's actually, you know, 1990s even, there's increased deregulation. So DIDMA doesn't fully accomplish what the architects of DIDMA hoped it would. And so there's increased financial deregulation, which happens in the 1980s. And then on top of that, what you also find is that there's increased investment, which is coming back to the United States, particularly in the aftermath, I'd sort of argue, of the collapse of the commercial real estate market in the Pacific Rim. So global investors are looking for places to park their money, and they ultimately decide to park it in the U.S. in the subprime mortgage market. And that becomes sort of a major driver of the rise of deregulation. So you get this law in 1980. Another law in 1982, which is probably even is at least as problematic and more troubling than DIDMA is a law called Garn-St-Germain, the Garn-St-Germain Act. And this law, Garn-St-Germain Act of 1982, it basically codifies nationally some of the most predatory and abusive instruments of mortgage lending, things like a balloon payment, in which there's a large payment at the end of a mortgage loan contract, things like a prepayment penalty, which is so counterintuitive to a consumer that you get penalized basically for paying your bill early. And so this law called Garn-St-Germain Act in 1982, again, expands the mortgage instruments that lenders are allowed to use in the market and target toward consumers. And the 82 law is even more problematic because it's being underwritten really by the financial services industry. And there's a lot of quid pro quo between Senator Freddie St. Germain, who the law is named after, as well as Jake Garn. They're being underwritten really by the financial industry. And so it's one way to think about subprime mortgages is that it's fruit of a poisonous tree because, again, these laws were not written with the consumer primarily in mind, but we're actually with institutional investors and large-scale mortgage investors in mind, not the consumer. So these laws are not really, again, designed with the consumer in mind as much as the lender.
You mentioned St. Germain. I think this is a good point maybe to kind of think about or you discuss who are the real villains of this book. And you talk a lot about what you call kind of the donor class and its kind of influence on a lot of this deregulation. I mean, who in this book could you really point to as kind of the architects of this deregulation?
Sure. I mean, the architects are sort of manifold. So and it didn't sort of, when I sort of embarked upon this project, I had no idea would sort of take this sort of turn. But in each of the spheres I sort of look at, you see a rise of influential donor class. In one phase, the donor class becomes the architect, right? Actually, literally sort of writing the laws for legislators that we see with the rise of subprime mortgage lending. In other places, what we see is that once laws are in place, it's the donor class, i.e. the insurance industry, for instance, with my chapter on auto insurance, which basically helps to defend and promote a particular industry. And we see this actually, too, with the student loan industry as well. In the origins of the rise of student loans, lenders were quite skittish with the idea of lending money to college students. And so if you could think about it from this perspective, Matt, I mean, here you say to, if you're a lender, so I'm going to give a 17-year-old poor kid, young man, a young woman with no credit history, no job, a loan, and they can pay me back in 4 years if they finish on time, or 7 years, right? I mean, just on the face of it, right? Lenders were very skittish about the terms of that. And so what happens is that the federal government has to sweeten the pot so much to bring lenders in that it becomes sort of counterproductive to sort of allocate these and distribute sort of loans. And so the donor class of the rise of student loan industry is not there as architects for student loans, but they come in a little bit later. Once they realize and recognize that the federal government has sweetened the pot so much and has incentivized underwriting these loans so much that it becomes an advantage for these lenders to underwrite these loans. So there you see lenders coming in at a very late, a much later stage, not coming in at the beginning, but actually coming in, let's say, by the mid 1980s and 1990s, especially though, eager to defend and protect the industry because the advantages and profitability of it. But they weren't there from the origins. And then in contrast to, let's say, the rise of subprime mortgage lending, in which the lenders were actually architects of the actual law. And so sometimes architects of the law in the very beginning, we see this rise of mortgage lenders and depository institutions often. The student loan industry is quite different. They're very skittish at the very beginning. They come in a little bit later to defend and promote and prop up the industry.
Yeah, the student loan story is really interesting, where you really take a close look at the Reagan administration. What I found really fascinating was, you know, how you talk about how the Reagan administration basically was able to group students receiving federal aid into the same category as kind of welfare recipients, right? Just characterizing them as undeserving tax eaters, right? How does the Reagan administration do that?
It does that because, I would sort of argue that it doesn't imagine, in terms of the imaginary of the administration, it doesn't imagine middle class white students in need of student loans. And so it's understanding the impression of who the borrower actually is someone who's fundamentally different than the average borrowers today. The average borrower today is a white individual, often a white woman, as the average borrower. They don't imagine the average borrower in the early 1980s to be a white individual. You imagine that to be a part of being a person of color, pop this sort of perception. And so the general view is that the student loan industry, the rise actually of student loans, and more broadly, student financial aid really comes about, or origins of it really at the federal level, it comes about in the 1950s under the Eisenhower administration. And really since the 50s and 60s, it was sort of a bipartisan understanding that investing in college students was an investment in the future of America, an investment in America's economic future, but also an investment in America's national security, because many of these loans in early years had to be in industries and fields which were central to defense, the sciences, math, foreign language skills. And so there's a perception that to invest in a college student in the 1950s, 1960s was to actually invest in America's future. This begins to change really in the 1980s, where Reagan, as you sort of mentioned, they redefine the perception of a student, not as a student as future tax contributor, but a student as a future tax, as a tax eater. And even so much so that now you may look at, if you have a student loan, this is called an origination fee. So every student loan that you have has an origination fee. Well, the early years of that origination fee, the implementation of it was originally designed in part to offset federal deficits. And so and this happens in the early 1980s. Again, so the working perception is that students were here to not be tax. Students here were basically tax eaters, and they need to sort of pull their own weight and pull their own share. And we see it with something as critical as an origination fee, again, which is designed, at least in its early implementation, to offset things like a federal deficit, a federal budget. So the shift from student as future tax contributor to student to tax eater, again, as you said, comes about with Reagan, his perception that students are no different than any kind of welfare recipient, and as I sort of mentioned here in my text, that they're leeches on the backs of taxpayers. This is actual language coming out of the Reagan administration. People like David Stockman and Terrell Bell sort of quoting and paraphrasing the perception of David Stockman. Terrell Bell is Secretary of Education. Stockman is OMB director, and this perception in the Reagan administration that these students were leeches on the backs of taxpayers, which is again the actual language. And so as you said, casting them as the undeserving poor.
Yeah, I wanted to bring out there. One thing that I love about this book is that it brings out so many, not just fascinating stories, but unexpected stories. And you know, just in the student loan chapter, I wanted to bring out a couple of these surprising stories. And one, you know, that I hadn't really thought about, which is about how one of the motivations for the Reagan administration in terms of transferring a lot of this money into student loans, you write about, is about Title IX regulation, which I had never thought about. And so how does the Reagan administration see the rollback of, you know, federal grants as a way for institutions to avoid Title IX?
Yeah. Sure. So actually some conservatives in the Reagan administration and outside recognize that the shift to student loans might weaken enforcement mechanisms and regulatory triggers of Title IX. And so as we all know, that Title IX was passed in 1972, guaranteed that no person shall, on the basis of sex be excluded from participation in or be denied benefits of or subjected to discrimination in any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And so, again, the perception was is that if you, because cultural conservatives believe that if you roll back the federal grant program was a way to sidestep Title IX enforcement. And so, again, many conservatives thought that Title IX enforcement was an overreach of the federal government. And so by rolling back the grant program and enlarging the loan program, they could sort of sidestep sort of Title IX. Was the working assumption and working aim and hope of the administration. So again, the student loan question brings in issues of class, gender, and race, absolutely.
Yeah. I love the chapter on auto insurance, and that's something I hadn't really thought about very much either. And so you write about how the auto insurance industry really drives the wealth gap. How does it do that?
Sure. And that's because, auto insurance is predicated as much upon where one lives as much as how one drives. And so, we live in a society ostensibly predicated on merit, individual merit, except there's this carving out in many ways of the auto insurance industry. And auto insurance is one of the rare sort of spaces in the political economy in which it's a financial product which is delivered exclusively by the private sector, right? But it's required by law to have. If you own an automobile, then you must have auto insurance. I'm from New Jersey. My family is from New Jersey. I remember my brother. He was working at a nice job and bought a brand new Acura. And drove it off the lot, was driving to Philadelphia to see his best friend. But he didn't have the insurance card in his car. New Jersey State Troopers pulled him over and proceeded to impound the vehicle. He owns the car outright, right? But it's illegal to drive without auto insurance if you have the car. Again, it has this unusual sort of carve out in the American political economy. Again, even more unusual than let's say health insurance, in which again it's a financial product which is delivered exclusively by the private sector, but is required by law to own. And so, the ways in which auto insurance sort of functions is that again it's predicated in large part upon one's zip code, and so where you live determines almost how much you pay. So if you have some free time, go on something like eSurance and then type in the same exact information, your make and model vehicle, your age, your gender, all these details, and change one indicator, just zip code, and use the zip code for the toniest neighborhood in your community, and then change that for zip code for the neighborhood which is considered to be the poorest. And what you'll find is that there's going to be a wide discrepancy in auto insurance pricing. And so what happens in the auto insurance sort of industry is that, again, zip code often becomes a proxy for race. And so the perception is that communities which are black and brown are often charged higher auto insurance rates. And so, again, this has been sort of played out and discussed in research across a wide swath of studies and agencies and think tanks. And so the insurance industry also argues that if they were to not take certain kind of identity factors into account, that it would actually have a disparate impact on women. They say, so yeah, we may charge more because of zip code, but if we took out all kind of identity factors, women would actually pay more. What that kind of argument sort of elides or sidesteps is the fact that the fact of feminization of poverty. What you find in these poor zip codes often are women, you might have more women of color. So what winds up happening is that more women of color often pay more in auto insurance because they're often residing in these poor sort of neighborhoods. Zip codes become a proxy for race and rise of auto insurance industry, and it's consistent in almost every state in the union. So I lay out a chapter which talks about the discrepancy in auto insurance and the ways in which we have a moment of progressive possibility in the mid-1980s or late 1980s, where both consumer groups and civil rights groups and some progressives come together and pass a consumer protection policy called Proposition 103, which is designed to have auto insurance predicated upon on how one drives, right? The merits of a motorist. And by how one drives, specifically like, how many accidents do I get into? Do I have traffic tickets? How long or far do I drive in terms of my vehicle? These are the merits of a motorist as opposed to simply one zip code. And so Prop 103 passes designed to have auto insurance primarily predicated upon the merits of a motorist. And what happens is that insurers step in and for a whole generation interpose and nullify the implementation of Prop 103. And for a generation, again, continues and perpetuates that wealth extraction from communities of color. And that's basically what we're talking about here, the wealth extraction of communities of color on arguments which are not predicated on individual merit, which, again, is the great irony that mm-hmm. this argument about auto insurance being need to be based upon social and environmental factors is the great fulcrum of the argument. At the same time in which we're going through the rise of affirmative action cases, in which almost the same populations of people are arguing that merit is the predicate of a free market society, of our society, and a society which should be based in predicate on individual merit. So I sort of teased out the absence of intellectual consistency and the cost that it actually wrought for communities of color throughout the country.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this great line you have here. And since I have it written down, I just want to read it for listeners because it gets to exactly what you're saying here. It really brings it out, where you write that the fact remained, however, that insurers' bottom line hinged on defending values that conservatives, moderates, and a growing number of liberals at the time found most objectionable, namely the privileging of social and physical environmental factors and identity politics over individual merit.
Absolutely. And I wish I could say it was sort of quarantined to that moment, but the perpetuation, and it's called a territorial rating system. Perpetuation of the territorial rating system still exists today. And so, I listened to the president who talks about having a meritorious system of immigration, right? Mm-hmm. Which if you want to make that argument, how about some intellectual consistency? And here I sort of say the argument is missing too. There is no more commonly held sort of financial asset in the U.S. than the automobile. Nine out of 10 Americans who live west of the Hudson River own an automobile, right? Mm-hmm. And that number is much larger than, let's say, the numbers of individuals who actually enter college or go to college or who are actually beneficiaries of affirmative action, or is the number of people who actually come into the U.S. based upon a lottery system, a non-merit immigration sort of policy system. And so here we have a public policy, auto insurance, which applies to almost, we can argue, as much as 90% of Americans, U.S. households. Much more ubiquitous in terms of the disparate treatment and the absence of merit compared to more shiny objects such as affirmative action in college or a merit-based immigration system. And so putting these things back in their context and perspective, and yet no one sort of talks about auto insurance and this disparate treatment of and the ways in which it transfers wealth, across wide swaths of American consumers.
Yeah. And you end the book talking about payday lending. And so you call payday lending arguably the most hazardous of all consumer loan products. And so, you know, for listeners who have never taken out a payday loan, I was wondering if you could kind of explain how a payday loan actually works and why they're so hazardous.
Sure. So, I'll put this in the sort of context. I mean, you're right. Very small percentages of Americans sort of take out payday loans. But we also know that 44% of Americans, according to a recent study of the Federal Reserve, indicate that they would have difficulty raising, coming up with $400 for an emergency cash loan. So while very few Americans may actually take out a payday loan, the precarity of the American consumer is sort of one step away from the payday loan. So it was critical in that sort of sense. So how does a payday loan operate and how does it work? You go to a payday loan shop and loan store, or you can use them online, and you basically you fill out a form. You can take out a loan for $300 with the promise of paying back that loan in 2 weeks, and that's why it's called a payday, because the assumption is that the average American consumer receives a paycheck every 2 weeks, and so so in exchange for that loan amount for $300, $400, you write a check to the payday lender, and that's critical too. So the payday loan population is not the unbanked. Right, these individuals, to take out a payday loan, you have to have two basic things. You have to have a job, right? It's payday, right? It's an expected check. And you must have a bank account. And these are, throughout much of the 20th century, we consider sort of pillars of the middle class, employment and the idea of a bank account. So that's sort of critical and important to know. So so you provide that lender this check for $300. In 2 weeks, he either cashes that check in his – well, the principal is $300, but the amount that you write a check for is often $350, $375. And if there's no money to cover that check, you go back to that payday lender and you basically roll over that – you roll over that loan and take out another loan to pay it for another 2 weeks later. And so the way the payday loans work is again, you take out a loan for $250, $300, the promise of paying back that loan plus interest, and the interest is usually triple-digit interest 2 weeks later. The average borrower cannot pay back that loan when they get their next paycheck. So what tends to happen is they often, as I mentioned before, roll over that payday loan. And so researchers show that a payday borrower is far more likely to actually go into bankruptcy than someone who's actually denied a payday loan. So these things are extremely, costly and expensive for the average borrower. And so, as a sort of mention before, you're actually better off being denied a payday loan than actually take one out, because you wind up moving closer to bankruptcy. And the average payday borrower spends more than two-thirds of a calendar year actually indebted to their payday lender. And so, again, it's a thriving industry. Recent research has shown that the industry has a bright and promising future if it can stay outside of regulatory coverage and regulatory oversight. And that's the primary concern of the industry is to stay in the shadows of financial and bank regulators. Or this is
I mean, so you just mentioned that some of the interest rates are in the triple digits, right? Just insane interest rates. And despite the fact that there are state laws that cap interest rates, right? And these are way over the caps that state laws set. So how do these payday loans institutions get around those state laws that set these limits on interest?
The ways in which they were able to get around the state usury caps was to place their headquarters or rent a charter from banks which had their headquarters in states like Delaware or South Dakota, which had less restrictive rate caps or had no rate caps at all on the amount of interest that he could charge the consumer. And this is how, again, payday lenders were able to circumvent state usury laws. And state legislators and state regulatory bodies allowed them in part to do this. In part because many of these state legislators were getting major campaign contributions and donations from those they were supposed to be regulating. And so so they were able to game the system, run around the system. So, I mean, Arkansas is a classic example. Arkansas had a very strict usury cap. In fact, not simply had a very strict usury cap. In Arkansas state constitution, again, the only state, I think, in the country within the state constitution, it capped interest rates. Yet and still, Arkansas was one of the most notorious spaces for payday lenders, who, again, as Mitch sort of charged exorbitant interest rates, triple-digit interest rates on their consumers. So if you could do it in a place like Arkansas, which in its own state constitution banned usury, you could certainly do it in every other state in the union.
You know, this book is just a maddening book to read. It's hard not to read it and just be frustrated with the deregulation and some of these financial instruments that are there. Is this just as frustrating to a book to write? I mean, what is it like writing a book like that?
It is frustrating because, I mean, there were peaks and valleys is a better way to put it. Part of the book, let me get back to this question about the origins of the book in many ways. The origins of the book actually started as I was researching my first book as a dissertation. The origins of the book actually starts out when I was a graduate student spending a year abroad actually in Cambridge, England, and where I lived in a house in which everyone not only came from a different state, but actually almost came from a different continent. And in that house, there were individuals who were first-generation college students now pursuing advanced degrees at Cambridge University. And so for me, it sort of militated against this perspective and view that America has some kind of exclusive hold on upward mobility. And that this Horatio Alger sort of story and myth was something that other countries, whether it's the UK, whether it's Singapore or others, were actually also involved and engaged in this idea of upper mobility. And so it pierced the myth that upper mobility was something that was exclusively owned by the U.S. Now, maybe America has exported this in many ways, but it certainly pierced the myth for me, upward mobility. So as I look externally at other countries and watched how the upward mobility of others, first generation students who are now entering into advanced degrees at prestigious universities globally, it also encouraged me to turn a gaze back in the U.S. and then begin to explore what are the working myths internally about the U.S. and this political economic system that exists. And so I began thinking and researching and writing this, particularly in the 1990s, in which we see the greatest period of economic expansion in U.S. history, simultaneously with increasing economic inequality, particularly of communities of color, but more broadly. And so this is a part of the sort of origins of this sort of project. I talk about the valleys and the ravines coming into the increased deregulatory policies of the 1980s and the impact that it has on across the board in terms of erecting barriers of mobility with a disparate impact on historically vulnerable populations. But also then we have the election of President Obama in 2008, not by any stretch a perfect vehicle for one's policies and positions, but understand the possibilities for change and with this rise of the CFPB and the Dodd-Frank Act, I say specifically, as progressive policy actions. And it wasn't simply mad and depressing to write because there were moments of possibility. I'm writing part of this book while I'm in Washington, D.C., when they're hammering out the Dodd-Frank Act. And I'm talking to principals who are actually on the ground trying to build the CFPB. These are great moments of possibility. And so these are moments of inspiration. It wasn't simply Matt in an essence because these were troughs of consumer financial inequality, but also thought there was some light in the tunnel. But little did I know light in the tunnel was actually a train named Donald Trump. I think I'll end it right there.
Yeah. Well, the book is Land of the Fee. Devin Fergus, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me, Matt. Thanks so much.